Hello, everyone, and welcome to Let's Take a Stab at It. I'm your host, John Hoyer, and with me is...
Jason Bartsch, and we got another temple-made guest for you guys today. Another fellow Al, if I'm not mistaken.
Paul Harold, everyone.
Hello, my name is Paul Harold. Hi, everybody. It's really nice to be with you guys. It's super cool.
We don't give the most flattering introductions on Let's Take a Stab at It.
Well, here's the thing. If it's bad, I'll just re-record it later. It's fine.
It's
or if I'm lazy, I won't.
Yeah.
It's very, very simple. All right. So to get to the point here, okay, Paul acted on this web series that we worked on called Losing Liam. And he was a young boy. You were like 17 then, right?
Yeah. Or 18. 17 or 18.
Yeah. So it's been a few years.
Yeah.
And you grew up right before our eyes.
That's debatable.
And now you're an actor. You're doing stuff.
They tell me. yeah, man. Thank you. I met these two dudes working on Losing Liam, where I played like this just like I guess this insufferable, snotty, like Reddit nerd. He was supposed to be like a Reddit nerd and he watched like a lot of hentai and he was supposed to be that really like jaded kid that like hated everything and didn't like anyone and was always like saying everything sucked. But like at the age of 17, I didn't know what a Reddit nerd was. And like all of the dialogue was full of like Richard Dawkins references and like... And I didn't, the thing about that is like the whole, like that whole, like archetype, that whole, like character, I didn't know what it was. I didn't know what Reddit was. I had done nothing but musicals my whole life. So I wasn't aware of like that kind of joke. And so I came in and I think Liam, the writer of the show, was like, this guy's completely wrong for the character. Cause I was like really bubbly and like really just, you know, trying to be everybody's friend. And I guess just nobody else auditioned because you guys let me do more episodes, which is great.
Well, I would say this, whether or not you're here, I'm not just kissing your ass. I directed the third episode and there was like a scene at a diner between you and Liam. And I remember like thinking quite frequently, man, is Paul so easy to work with? I will give a note and then he like listens to the note and then like applies it to the next like take we do. And I was like, he's an actor.
So did Liam actually make you audition or how did you get this role? I don't know how any of these characters actually got the role. I just showed up and started shooting it. So what's the story there?
Oh, well, I had done this play with Creative Works of Lancaster the producer, Nelly, she was in the play. And because I had done that play with her, I guess I became part of her pool of like young teenagers that she knew. And so she wound up producing Losing Liam. They needed a teenager. I got an email from her being like, do you want to audition for a web series? I was currently doing my high school musical production of Sound of Music. But I was getting ready to go off to college to Temple where I was going to major in acting. And I was like, well, I want to do movies. I want to do TV shows. And I was like, oh my God, an audition for a web series. This is huge for me. Like, this is the thing that's going to jumpstart my career.
That's your big break.
This is the one. So I like went to the director of Sound of Music and I was like, listen,
I quit.
I need you. I was like, listen, the part, you know, the part of Uncle Max means the world to me. You know, that the part of Uncle Max is the dream. I got Hollywood called. Hollywood now. And as a thespian, I must answer. And she gave me permission. She was like, fine, just like stop being weird, you know? Stop doing that thing. Weird. And I went and I auditioned, right? And the lines were supposed, you know, the lines were like, this director sucks. I like Richard Dawkins. And I was like, whoa, this director sucks. I like Richard Dawkins. And they were in the, they were like, yeah, this isn't quite, and somehow I got it and I got to meet you guys and now we're friends still, which is really cool. And that's how that happened. Long-winded story.
So Paul put his future on hold for Losing Liam and we're in year 7 of post-production currently. So
he'll get it together and it'll be released and it'll be great. So
yeah, it's an awesome show. It's really, really good. And everything's really good.
So Paul, what kind of got you into acting specifically, and you know, as opposed to like directing or any of these other like sections?
Well, to be honest, you know, I was about 5 years old when my parents stuck me in a theater camp. You know, at the Fulton Theater, they had theater camps for, you know, young kids. And I knew I loved movies. I, you know, it was the whole imagination thing. I loved Lord of the Rings because I loved watching them sword fight. I was a kindergartner. But in my kindergarten mind, I was like, well, I want to do that. I want to sword fight in Lord of the Rings. And my parents were like, we should put him in theater camp. So they did. And, you know, it was through theater camp that I started doing, you know, musicals. You know, I was musicals, you know, I was 10 and I started doing musicals at like the Fulton and the Dutch Apple Dinner Theater and like local theaters that where I could go and be 10 and sing songs on stage with, you know, these older actors and get, you know, paycheck for $75 and feel really good about it. And I just kind of never stopped, you know. It was like theater camp pipeline to musical theater pipeline to like that little break in middle school where I was like, I hate theater. I want to play in punk bands. That's what I'm going to do. And then like by high school, I was doing theater. I just never, I think it was, I mean, also Halloween, like, and this is like, has to do with my love of horror movies, which is like kind of my biggest love in the world, which is why I'm happy to be here. But like, I loved Halloween. I loved dressing up. I loved the theatricality of it. I love the theatricality of like people making home haunts in their yard and special effects and fake blood and capes. I loved all of that. And I think, you know.
So your parents, they could have sent you to like sword fighting camp if, right? If that's what you wanted to do. So you you could, there's like some alternate timeline where you're like one of the best sword fighters in the world, I think. You know,
how you don't know how much sword fight training I took in college. Like so much intensive sword fight training. So much. I'm not even kidding, dude. Broadsword, small sword, rapier and dagger, single sword. Like the amount of sword fight training that I had to take in college was huge. So yeah.
Was that like a class, like sword play one or something?
Yeah, sword play for the actor. And there were like multiple tiers of it, you know, and we were taught by Fight Master Ian Rose, who's like one of the most renowned fight directors in the country. He has the rank of Fight Master. Disney hired him to train John Boyega when he was cast in Star Wars. And he's super hardcore and super good at what he does. So yeah, the sword fighting thing happened. And yeah, I've been fortunate enough to like get to do some of that since graduating.
That's awesome. So if you were ever in a situation where you had to actually fight someone with a sword, like your life depended on it, would you know how to actually harm them? Or would you know only how to act like you're harming them?
So believe it or not, everything we learned in swordplay is like 100% real. 100% real attack techniques, 100% real defense techniques.
Wow.
Then they would teach us the real stuff, and then they would have us alter things like distance to make it stage safe. So, you know, we would be just out of distance that we could be like attacking the target, but like at a full extension, it wouldn't hurt somebody. So, yeah. And they would make us fence. They would bring in fencing gear and tie us up and make us fight for real. Make us apply all the stuff and use it in real settings so that we could, quote, like, feel what the danger feels like. You know, dude, we had can I tell a weird story? I had to take this unarmed combat training too, and one of the exercises was you have to get a partner, put your hands together, close your eyes, so both of you have your eyes closed, and then you hit each other, right? And like it's supposed, you know, and you're supposed to, like, even though your eyes are closed, feel where their hits are coming and deflect their hits with your arm. And then you're supposed to hit them and they're supposed to, you know, your eyes are closed. So you're feeling each other's energies. Exactly. And they made us do that in a class for like theater where you're never actually hitting the person. But this was a real hitting exercise. So I was paired up with this girl who was professional, like MMA fighter. That's what she did. Professional MMA fighter. Total badass. Amazing. Awesome chick. Her name is Julia. And, just like super badass, like Terminator chick. So we got ready to do our thing. She had just like gotten some belt, you know, from beating somebody's ass. We like put our hands together. We closed our eyes. We were like ready to do the exercise where we like punching each other. And I decided for some terrible reason to be like, hey, Julia, before we do this, just so you know, I just want you to know that like I'm kind of an MMA fighter and like kind of have some martial arts training. So I just want you to know that like, I'll take it a little easy on you. You know, I don't want to hurt you. She bruised me for like 3 weeks. Like Alec didn't even try. Absolutely. Like I was like 10 different colors of purple on my chest. And I was, you know, I wasn't being mean. I thought that we'd both have like a little giggle. We'd both have like a little wink.
Because like, you woke up in a hospital 12 hours later.
Yeah, dude, I still don't remember parts of my childhood. Yeah, so that's what going to acting school is like. Truly.
So, Paul, what are you working on anything currently, acting wise? Anything you want to tell us about?
Well, it's funny you asked. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, so after quarantine hit, I had some work lined up, some good work, and it was all gone. You know, gone in a split second. So my best friend James, who's also an actor, really good actor, we're left kind of being like, well, what do we do? What can we do? We have to move forward. We can't move forward. There's the landscape of this industry is dead. And kind of the entire time that James and I were working as actors, we would always kind of come back to each other and be like, are you happy? No. Are you happy? No. What do we really want to do? And it was always like, well, if we had our dream, we'd like go out to Vermont and just like make horror movies in a barn or something. So when quarantine hit, we were like, I guess we should be just make horror movies now. So we started a production company. We started a production company. This is the first time really talking about this to anyone aside from like our team. And we're making a horror feature this summer.
Wow.
A found footage horror feature. Yeah, I'm really excited to like talk to you guys about it. And yeah.
Can you tell us anything about it? Can you give us like the elevator pitch? Or
I totally can. So it's called Algernon. It's about a troop of young actors who are starting a theater company. And they've moved back to their hometown from Chicago, after being unemployed for a little while to start this company. And they're trying to find like the big play that's going to put them on the map, get them lots of donors, get them lots of, hype. And they find this old Elizabethan play in verse that's supposedly cursed. The actor lore goes like whoever does this play, whatever company does this play will die.
Yeah.
And so they're like, well, obviously we have to do this play. This is going to be the thing to really get us there. And of course, it's a horror movie. They start to do the play and horrible things start happening and they have to contend with that. So yeah, that's cool. The pitch.
It's
going to be,
I dig it.
Thank you.
So when is this what's the timeline for this?
We're in pre-production now. We've got, been working on it for, we've been working on it for like a year, but we're doing like the immediate logistical pre-prep right now. And then we're going to be shooting early June through late July.
In Philly or?
Lancaster. In Lancaster. We're going to be running around here. Yeah. Ooh. Running around here. It's great because my parents live here. And so they can provide all the craft services without me having to pay for that.
Are they guys you went to school with or?
Yeah, folks from Temple, cool. Folks from Temple. And we're all crewing ourselves too. We've got like a tiny batch of all vaccinated people. Like all the actors are also going to be crewing. We've got a DP. We've got, we've got a couple of like miscellaneous like PAs that are also going to be like spooky creatures. We're going to be doing sound ourselves and it's going to be like really guerrilla style, just kind of like running around, getting shots where we can, just kind of point and click and go in a smart way. I promise we're not fuck ups. I promise we've worked really hard to make it happen and make it tight.
Well, that sounds cool, man. You guys will have a lot of fun with that. And the found footage aspect gives you a kind of a little more, I think, room to play with as far as, it doesn't have to look as polished. It's part of the aesthetic. So was that totally intentional or was it you just wanted to do found footage?
It was both. It's like this gives us we have to work as hard as we can to like make it look good. But we're also a bunch of theater actors. Like we only know what we know. We didn't go to film school. So it's like it gives us the cushion to like to not, not have the like industry standard and to make mistakes and to still ultimately come out with something that's good.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not a fan of found footage films that are too polished, where you like start to mm-hmm. like not even realize you're watching a found footage film anymore. So
you're like, oh yeah, this is found footage. Yeah. I forgot that. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, definitely. And the thing is, I don't know. It's like the angle of this film is most production crews most people who make found footage movies or who are young, scrappy filmmakers trying to make a film, they like have all the film knowledge. And then they're like, well, what are we going to do about actors? And then they put their friends and themselves and their families in it. Whereas like, we're a bunch of actors. We got that covered. What are we going to do about making a movie? So it's like, well, the answer is found footage. That's the answer. And, I've never really seen a found footage movies about a movie about Shakespeare actors, and I know that that's something special and different. And I know that like we have Shakespeare actors that are good. We are them. We got degrees. Yeah. We got degrees, baby. We're going to do it. So yeah, I think it'll be cool. That's awesome. That's what I think.
That sounds exciting. That'll be,
thanks for asking me about
looking
it.
Looking forward to that.
All right. So let's move on to what we've been watching. Jason, what have you been watching lately?
So I guess we can keep the found footage theme going. I guess like a week or two ago, I showed my wife The Blair Witch Project for the first time. She'd never seen it. And
oh, nice.
It's been years since I've seen it. And that is still one of the scariest movies I've ever seen. Like, we started late night. Like, I was like, I'll show it to her. You know, we'll start it and finish it some other time. And then we watched the whole thing. And it's so engaging. And it's just like a found footage film done right. I think it set the standard. And just, it's a perfect example of, you know, what you don't see is often scarier than what you do see. And they just, you know, they play that up so well. And this round, especially this time watching it, I really appreciated like the aspect of being afraid of being lost in the woods. Cause like they capture that very well. Like witches aside, like they're lost. Like the whole map thing, all the anxiety. And you know, when they like walk all day and come back to the place they started, it feels so like hopeless and so devastating, and it
like wears you down.
It really does. And so that's something I appreciated this time watching it, was how well they captured that anxiety. And then just like the sound design is great, just the little like cracks you hear in the distance, and like subtle, like, you know, the moaning in the distance and somebody like crying for help. And you know, the cameras turn on at all the right times. And it's just like, sometimes you'll just see the black and white footage, and sometimes you'll just hear something. And it's used in a way that feels kind of natural to, you know, how the story is unfolding.
And because they have two cameras, it allows for a little bit more, I think, tighter editing about like what occurs and what, you know, that you can cut and get quote unquote best shots, as opposed to sometimes, you know, I don't know, like Cloverfield. Sometimes I thought that movie, it took a little while for it to get going.
It had
another thing happening. And with Blair Witch, it's like, oh, like you get all the good stuff.
Yeah. And just like, and the characters like just slow descent into madness. Like you get to a point where as an audience, you're like, why are they still like even filming? But you know, there's a scene where Heather, she's like, you know, like, this is all I have left. Just let me do this. Like, it's the only like thing that is giving her any sort of sense of normalcy, because like everything else is just so hopeless. And it all just works together really well. And then after watching that, I was like, oh, I want to watch the new one, the new Blair Witch. And
even better.
Was not a fan. This is one of those movies like we were talking about just a little bit ago, is like, it felt like there were times where I forgot it was a found footage film. There's way too much coverage and it looks way too good.
And they've got drones and stuff, and they have to make the drones diegetic.
I did like the drone kind of aspect of it. You know, it was at least kind of, you know, an interesting new, you know, toy.
But it was so weird that they had like body cams that they would then, it would clearly be a cameraman is holding the camera doing that stuff.
Right.
And it's just like, I think like they should have had the balls to stick to like actually have used body cam stuff and then just, you know.
And I believe they did. They also added like non-diegetic sound and like those like creepy little like horror sound effects and stuff. And it wasn't just all like natural sound from the scenes. And I think that took me out of it a little bit too. I don't know. It just felt like a rehash for the sake of rehashing it. And then they added that whole like kind of supernatural element, how they're in some sort of like time warp in the woods. I don't know. It didn't feel necessary. I know I was texting John complaining about it, but I'm not going to go on too long about it.
Folks, it was quite fun because Jason rarely complains about anything, and he was going off about this.
It also had the misfortune of me watching the Blair Witch Project right before it. So I was like watching them consecutively, and I was like, this does not like hold a candle to the original. And so that was working against it. But if you know you have big shoes to fill, if you get into something that ambitious, you know, you better bring it. And I don't think they brought it. That's my take. for what it's worth. John, what have you been watching?
So I, because we were watching It Follows, I kind of wanted to pick something that felt similar. So I was like, oh, I love John Carpenter. And I had just gotten the 4K Blu-ray of They Live. So I put that in.
Nice.
And for those that don't know, if they've been living under a rock, the movie, sorry, Jason.
you know, so, damn well I haven't seen it.
No, well, I'm going to pitch it to you. Hopefully you'll watch it. So They Live, it's about Rowdy Roddy Piper in a serious acting role, discovers a pair of glasses, and when he puts them on, he can see that there are all these aliens among us who are like these rich, like financial types and stuff. So him and Keith David band together and they fight against these group of aliens that are taking all the money, taking control of society and stuff. And if anyone's ever seen like a sign that says obey, like that's what it's from. Like, he opens like magazines and like instead of like the photos of stuff, it says like obey and other things like consume, you know, whatever. You know, it's tongue in cheek. It's fun. I mean, one of my favorite lines, people have said it a bunch, but it's Roddy Piper has a shotgun and he goes, I'm here to chew bubblegum and kick ass. And I'm all out of bubblegum. I didn't do it as the justice it deserved, but it has a pretty good message about like social and economic inequality. And I think especially for a movie that occurred in the 80s, I thought that was a pretty strong message for them to put out there. So I highly recommend it, especially the 4K Blu-ray from Screen Factory is beautiful.
Nice.
So, yeah.
Do they sponsor and, you? 4K Screen Factory?
We
the sponsorship?
Throughout this series, we just kind of name drop a lot and hope that something sticks. But
I can do that. Leo DiCaprio. Is that good?
We usually aim a little lower, but thank you, Paul.
Oh, Paris Hilton.
So split the difference, Paul.
Anyway. So, Paul, what have you been watching recently?
No, I've been watching a lot of pretty much any like really cheaply made found footage I can get my hands on, like made by, you know, passionate people with no money, just to see what they can come up with. And I watched Death of a Vlogger, and it is so fantastic. You'd both really like it. It's this movie about this vlogger who is vlogging, you know, filming himself. And through his vlogs, you get to experience that he's being haunted. And the movie does a lot of employs some like really amazing minimalist scares. Like you've got a lot of like first person first person shots of him like walking through his dark hallways, trying to see what's around the corner that he just like filmed by himself in his apartment with his iPhone, you know. And then these like incredibly terrifying sequences of like first person movement through these like labyrinthine hallways with all this like lighting contrast of light and dark and open doors and sharp corners and like sequences like that where, you know, every time there's a pan or every time there's camera movement, you're terrified of what's gonna be there. You're terrified of what's gonna be there when the camera pans back. You're terrified of what's gonna be around the corner behind the door. Like all of that use of movement and timing and lighting in a first person tracking shot, essentially, with just this one guy in his apartment, and he made this incredibly terrifying film, and it's awesome. So
that's cool. Is that a feature, a short film, or is it?
Yeah, it's a feature. It was on Prime when I watched it. It was made in Scotland, I believe. Yeah, it's incredibly good. It's the ghosts, the creatures are just like people in sheets. I'm not kidding. And it's somehow it's terrifying. It's so terrifying and so simple. And it still also manages to have like a really cool conversation about like, what does it mean to like live your life in front of an audience? You know?
Yeah. I like the vlogger angle. I feel like, you know, every other person you meet these days has a vlog, and it's just like, I don't know. It's so weird how like accessible people choose to make their lives. Well, I guess it's a curated version of their lives, but I don't know. It's just like, and there's just some things on YouTube that are so mundane yet so captivating. It'll just be like someone sitting down for like dinner, like not even saying anything, just like a first person got like a GoPro strapped on them, watching somebody make hibachi or something, and it has like 12 million views. Or like, you know, I saw one the other day that was like, it was just like a guy shopping at yard sales, like, you know, trying to get bargains and stuff, and it had like 2 million views. And I'm like, this is like, I'm like, who's watching? First of all, I'm watching it, but I'm like, who else is watching this? And it's just, I don't know. It's just so odd. And I feel like kind of the whole vlogging, you know, YouTube generation kind of opens up a whole new world for found footage films, which is exciting. And Prime, you can go down a rabbit hole with Prime found footage, which I was doing after we watched
so much of it.
Blair Witch. Did you ever happen upon one called Bad Ben?
Yeah, dude, that's crazy because Bad Ben, that guy made like 20 Bad Ben movies. And the two of the actors in like the most recent Bad Ben movies are Philly comedians that just worked on a feature with a friend of mine. And like everybody in Philly like knows them. They're like two like Philly hotshot comedian, Matt and Jackie.
I could not believe like how many there were. And like,
never heard of it.
It's odd. It became like a cult thing. It's like one of those things kind of like The Room, how you don't know if like he intended for it to be what it is, but it turned into like kind of like a cult, like comedy sort of horror.
Yeah.
And it's just this like, you know, middle-aged guy, this like baby boomer who buys a house to flip and it's like haunted. I mean, this is the first one anyway. I don't know what the other seven are about, but and it's just him and he I don't know how this guy is in real life, but I get the impression that he's just kind of like acting like himself and just going through this house and there's all these little like scares and stuff and he's realizing it's haunted, but it's just like super low budget. Like I looked up, the budget was like $300. I'm like, what did they, what was $300 for this? Like the phone he shot it on, but it's just like,
right.
He'll, and one funny aspect is like, he buys it at like a sheriff's auction and like, he walks in, he's like, oh, that's weird. They like left all their belongings here and everything. And I was like, dude, you just, like, this is clearly your house. You just don't want to empty your house. Like, you just like
100%. Yeah. And the way he talks to the ghosts too, is like, so like nonchalant. He's like, hey, it's actually not your house. Actually, it's my house. So there you go.
And he has
you know?
Like little like scuffles with him and stuff.
Oh yeah. He's like writhing around. So and the funny thing is he made so many of these movies that like, while the first one was just like a very crudely done found footage, through like the eighth one, he's kind of turned himself into this like Ash from Evil Dead character where it's like, it's this man. This man is like almost a myth who is like constantly brought back to like do battle with the ancient demons.
It seems like he's like a swell guy who really embraced it. I mean, I only know what I know from the first one and reading about it a little bit, but it seems like at least as the series went along, he started to embrace like the comedy aspect of it and just kind of how over the top it was. But I was like, what is this? It was so bizarre. I'm so glad that you heard of it.
Bad Ben, dude. Crazy. Yeah. People love Bad Ben.
I'll have to check some of them out. All right, let's move on to our review of It Follows.
All right, the synopsis for It Follows. After sleeping with her new boyfriend for the first time, Jay begins being stalked by a mysterious shape-shifting figure that follows her wherever she goes, trying to kill her. It can take the form of a complete stranger or someone she knows. In order to rid herself of the curse, she must sleep with someone else to pass it on. So I feel like this is kind of an interesting next step in this horror series, or this slasher series, rather. First of all, it's not specifically a slasher. Nobody has a knife. No one's getting stabbed. It's not particularly gory either, which is interesting. There's a lot of implied kind of gore. But I mean, this is an interesting one. I think it fits nicely in this series. I know you guys are both big fans of it. John, what are your thoughts on this one?
Yeah, so I really like the movie. It scratches that John Carpenter itch where it's got these like, you know, the camera is very like slow and methodical, the way it pans around and reveals certain images and whatnot. It's very confident in the way that it presents things. And I just love that. And it's also got kind of this like, you know, weird kind of dream logic to the movie. And to me, almost like kind of reminded me of like if someone was to just have taken like Halloween and Nightmare on Elm Street and just kind of smushed them together. And you got It Follows, and it's got like a weird kind of killer that doesn't quite have the same personality, doesn't have any personality, really. It's kind of like an interesting development in like some of these slasher tropes. A lot of these like slasher films, it's like, if you have sex, you die. And in this one, that's like made literal. Like, when you have sex with someone, you are going to die unless you pass it on to someone else. So You have that. And then, you know, but then also it's kind of weird because it has these undefined rules for this character. You know, you're not really quite sure, oh, how does this completely work? A lot of it's, you know, from the perspective of like kids who don't really know what's happening. It's just, they're just understanding things just from what they're perceiving. And it kind of creates this like dread and anxiety in the story. So I really love all of that. And Paul, I mean, you jumped at the idea of being on this podcast, so you must love the movie, right?
Yeah, I love this movie a lot. Well, don't get me wrong. Yeah, I love this movie a lot. I think it's genius, you know? I think it like completely turns the genre on its head and does like things with the genre, you know, of slasher that like I don't think anyone's ever really done before. Like in a lot of slasher, like the tension and the anxiety and the fear really happens in moments of like action and, you know, pursuit. And, mm-hmm. You know, it's scary when you see the character, when you see the death, and when, you know, when the death is imminent. And in It Follows, the scariest moments are in moments of complete stillness. Mm-hmm. When you're waiting in line for a movie, when you're lying in a hospital bed, when you're sitting in a room talking to your friends, because the sheer idea of something that is always walking towards you, no matter where you are, anywhere in the world, the thing is walking to you, means that stillness is the scariest thing, the most terrifying thing. And it's the idea of, it's not even on screen, it's somewhere walking. Mm-hmm. That idea alone is terrifying. It's more terrifying than Michael Myers. It's more terrifying than the big strong thing is coming to kill you. It's like, it's more terrifying than, you know, like Freddy and Big Claws. It's something is walking. And I think taking an idea that's invisible, like an idea that you don't even have to see on the screen, the idea is that powerful that like just a shot of me sitting here watching a movie in a movie theater is terrifying to the viewer, because you're like, move, you can't sit down. So why are you sitting down? Something is coming. And I think the ability to take scenes of stillness and make them the most tense, so that, you know, never letting the viewer relax ever is pretty genius, you know?
And I think like that kind of goes with what we were saying about like the way it's filmed is mm-hmm. kind of in that slow methodical way too. So like it kind of, I don't know, like amplifies that a little bit, like almost like the tone of the film is kind of in the way that the antagonist, you know, like the
right.
it is. Mm-hmm. And I think that's as someone who really enjoys the aesthetics of like the technical aspects, I really appreciate how that it kind of embraces that kind of style in a way that works thematically, character-wise, etc. So
right, like the pacing of the editing parallels the idea of somebody slowly walking towards you all the mm-hmm. time. Yeah, that's, I didn't even think about that, John. You damn genius. You went to film school, didn't you? At Temple University. So
there's a lot of debate, or I guess some debate, as to what it is in this film. Like, what is following them? And, you know, there's a few different takes. You know, people say it could be, you know, a symbol for death or mortality. One of the more kind of obvious ones is, you know, the you know, like STDs or sort of sexual trauma, you know, following you around. But yeah, there's no denying like it feels like there is a certain inevitability to this, whatever this thing is catching up to them. And
yeah,
I think that's an interesting aspect. You know, if you look at it as say it represents death, you know, I think it's a good metaphor for death. Because the one character at one point says, you know, it's slow, but it's smart. So it's like death is slow, but, you know, it's going to find you. And that idea that you mm-hmm. can like try to prevent it, you can try to outrun it as much as you want, but it's going to find you like just one way or another, no matter where you are. You know, that's pretty terrifying in itself.
So, and I think like, so kind of for me, it's interesting how the movie, when I watch it at different points in the movie, my kind of feeling of what it is or what it's supposed to represent kind of changes over the course of the film. And it's happened a few times. I, you know, I've seen it a few times and I'm always kind of like a little bit, you know, there's just so much room for interpretation that I just find myself changing my tune.
And I get a sense
along,
that's what the director wants out of this. He kind of wants people to be able to have different interpretations of this, and you know, mm-hmm. one isn't necessarily right or wrong. You can justify, you know, several different angles of this.
What I would say for me is my kind of interpretation of it more so kind of deals with kind of mortality more specifically. And I guess like what I've always kind of like wondered, because like the STD thing seems pretty like it's not, I wouldn't say it's quite just surface level or anything, but it's like the interpretation that's the easiest to like kind that, of
yeah,
track and throughout.
Like that angle is interesting, but it feels a little like almost like a PSA, like a really like
yeah. Right. A little reductive. But what I like is that there's frequently a lot of points in the movie where characters talk about stuff when they were younger, or like that guy Hugh mentions something about wishing he could trade places with a little kid because the kid has his life ahead of him. Or Jay later in the movie is like sitting on a swing set, like, and that relaxes her. And I think like, so like this kind of idea of like the movie kind of being about people that are like kind of on the cusp of adulthood, and like sex is kind of seen as kind of like that, almost like a trigger as like an adult's act of some sort. So like you have these people that have sex, and then it's like all of a sudden now they're dealing with their own mortality. It's like, I'm an adult now. I'm going to die soon.
That's a good point. And it's interesting because it's almost like the whole mortality aspect, you could also put like it symbolizes the gradual loss of innocence, because part of getting older and part of, you know, at least growing old and eventually dying of old age is the older you get, you know, you're just constantly losing your innocence. And, you know, if you're not careful, you can get at like a more cynical view of the world if you don't kind of recalibrate as you go. Mm-hmm. So I feel like we're seeing all these kids kind of starting to kind of shed their innocence throughout this. And one of the things that really stuck out with me viewing it this time is this kind of this world he created, where it's like, I knew you have in the notes here, John, it's like it's almost like a timeless setting, where it's like you have like these, it's like old cars and old theaters and old TVs. They watch like black and white TVs, and you know, they play Old Maid on the porch at one point. But then there's also like this newer technology in it. And I think it's kind of really representing just how simple things were as a kid, how literally black and white they were. Like it was just like, you know, it's this very kind of cookie cutter nostalgic world that they're growing up in.
And they also have like, if you look at the characters that populate the movie, are all like neighbor kids that are all like good friends with each other. And they all have like a long history of like things that occurred, like the character Paul, he talked about how his first kiss was with Jay, you know, so like it has like, you know, they all have this history. And I think there's some implication that like some of the parents don't get along with each other, but like the kids still like each other. And I just think that feels so true, you know, and like it feels almost like a little bit kind of quaint as well, like maybe almost like something you would see more in like an 80s movie. But it's again, like we were saying, there's like a timeless quality to that, where it doesn't quite say, oh, we're in the 80s, we're in 2015 or whatever it was when it came out.
That actually, I think watching it today, I noticed that like the nebulous time period also kind of serves the story in a couple of moments, because like we're watching the scene where they go to the school, right? They're trying to track down the ex-boyfriend, and they go into the school and they're walking through the hallways. You know, it's the school's like in Boston or something. They're from Detroit. My girlfriend's watching it with me, and she's like, there's no way these people could just go into a school. That doesn't make. And I was like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
This could be pre-Columbine. Like this lives in a world that is both pre and post Columbine. So like that kind of like amorphous time setting, like kind of serves a story and like allowing characters to do certain things without like people poking plot holes.
It does
in
just
it, you know?
Feel like a different timeline, like our world in a different timeline. I think he pulled that off well.
Totally.
Also, I like that as like they're trying to figure out the mystery, it's like all the kids stick around to like see what happens. And it doesn't seem like weird. Like, why do they keep like they accumulate like more people to help out? But it's they're like, well, we got to figure it out, don't we? Like, and I think like that's, I don't know. I find that's very like 80s kind of like Goonies or something, you know, like that kind of thing was more popular with the like movies back then. I don't know. I kind of dig that.
It's just nice that like in, you know, while the filmmakers are throwing this character into so much trauma, they're also willing to like make sure that she has like an incredible community, like make sure that she has like unwavering support of this group of friends. And it's like, okay, they're being incredibly cruel to their character, but they're also making sure that like they're being kind to her in some ways too, because like, I don't know, if you're looking at it from like a sexual trauma point of view, it's like, which I think, you know, it's, I think there's lots of the, like lots of the film that is having a conversation about that in addition to everything else. It's like, yeah, it's like people need community, you know, and like that's the thing that people need to get, you know.
Yeah, it's kind of like, well, if you look at the comparison to like how Jay's character dealt with that, she had friends who were there for her to help. Meanwhile, the guy Hugh, it was like weirdly like he was on his own and like was, well,
there's that line, right? When wasn't there a line where people were like, he was like, nobody believed me.
Mm-hmm.
They're like talking about it, and he was like, well, I like nobody believed me when I said anything about it.
And I would also, the other thing about that is like, I think the movie is kind of smart in that they make it feel like a very insular world where it's like all these kids are dealing with it.
Mm-hmm.
Not like there are parents that are there, but like you barely see their faces throughout the movie. Or if they're there, like you see a little bit of their face or something, but it's not like you cut to a scene and two characters are talking and it stays on them or something. It's just right. Like,
yeah, there's just like a presence, which I think works really well. Like in the, one of the earlier scenes in the film, how their mom's just sitting at the table, like staring out the window, drinking wine, and she's just like in the background. It's like, it's kind of, right, it's like the first right. Toy Story film when like you don't see any of the parents' heads. It's because it's all like from the view of the toys and the children.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, the parents are in like photos on the wall, but that's it.
Or they're like,
or they're out there, right, and like,
or
like
they're,
you said,
used at, for like to be like the it or whatever will, yeah, take
I,
their
I don't
form
know like
something.
I guess they're you know, the filmmaker's kind of trying to show like, you know, these parents aren't, I guess, really involved, or at least Jay's mom, you know, is kind of disconnected. But it's, there's also this aspect, you know, when you're a kid, it feels like your world and your friend's world exists outside of your parents, and you want to figure things out outside of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like that was kind of an aspect of not showing the parents as much either, because like, you know, even just like having the neighborhood kids that you just hang out with based on, because of proximity, it's like you guys all just know each other and you're just chilling, and it's like,
yeah.
You know, your parents aren't a part of that. Like you have like your own little like almost community outside of your nuclear family.
Sorry, there's also something to be said for the fact that like, depending on the time period too, if it's 80s, parents are Puritans. Like parents are medieval about certain things, particularly sex. I know this because growing up, my parents were weirdly medieval about that stuff. They were like, you're abstinent or we'll kill you. I mean it. So these kids aren't going to be coming to their parents with these problems. They're not. They're not gonna be like, I had a sexual experience and something's coming to kill me. Because frankly, a lot of parents would be like, well, get out of my house in this time period, you know.
And that's a perfect justification for why they're all trying to figure it out alone without like, you know, adult help.
Right.
It also helps, I think, with the idea of them deciding to pass it on, because if you're an adult, let's say, or much older, you would weigh the options of like, well, I don't want to risk someone else getting killed just to delay something for myself. I would, you know, whereas if you're a kid, it's so much easier to be like, oh, this could be something I could kind of push away for a bit. Like you're not really considering like the gravity of the situation as much.
Well, and part of growing up is learning to take ownership over things that you may have done incorrectly. And I think it's like representing kind of that crossroads where you're figuring out, you know, you like your actions have consequences and they can hurt other people, and you don't really think that way as like a young kid. You kind of develop that empathy as you grow up. So I think that's kind of part of their transition as well in this film.
All right, so let's get into the plot of this movie. So the first thing we see, you know, we get this really cool panning shot in this you know, suburban neighborhood. The camera sees a girl come out of her house, and she looks shocked and scared. She runs away. Neighbors are like, are you okay? What's going on? And
this feels like it's right out of Halloween too. Like, this,
oh yeah.
Like,
yeah.
The street, everything. It's got big Halloween vibes.
And I love that. Like the music kind of kicks in when she runs around. I actually, funny enough. So I've seen people criticize this scene because they're like, what was the point of what she was doing? And then like someone created some like video showing where it would be in the scene. And it makes sense. Like she runs away from the house for it to kind of follow her there. She loops back around so she can go back into her house, grab the keys, get in the car and drive the fuck out of there. Yeah. And like you got her father asking her if she's okay. And, you know, it's a great introduction to the movie. It really like hits you right away. And you had that music, like the score by I think it was Disaster Piece was the band or whatever.
It's cool.
So
man.
Good. So good. I love that. And
her sitting on the beach then is like so eerie, just like waiting and making that phone call.
Mm-hmm.
It's like,
and then it's like with what Paul was saying about that stillness. So then you get this shot where the camera is on her car and like kind of further away and you don't see anything, but it's like you keep scanning to see, oh, wait, is there something there that I can see coming, you know, and you can't see anything. It then just cuts to her mangled corpse and you're like, holy shit, you know, like,
yeah.
And mm-hmm. you kind of wonder, like, how did that occur? You know, what does a, you know, like a killer or whatever do for like someone to be mangled looking like that, you know? So it's
very jarring. And it's almost like she's just like given up. Like she's been, you feel like she's been, you know, trying to evade this thing for so long. Cause she's just like, she's at the water. She's sitting at like the water's edge. There's not very mm-hmm. far for her to go. It's like, she's just like waiting for the inevitable. And, you know what, when you get a little more context later on, it's just like it's pretty devastating. And she like calls her dad and her parents and just like mm-hmm. apologizes for, you know, being a typical teenager and not being the most respectful in how she loves them and everything. And mm-hmm. great opening scene.
And I guess I didn't really think about this till this time watching it, but I guess, are we supposed to assume that this girl was somebody who was with Hugh and like he
was she the girl from his high school photo?
I'm not sure about that one.
It could be. I wouldn't be surprised if I mean, it's hard to say, but
I mean, that could low be key, a nice little we'll talk about this later, but I tend to feel that our boy Hugh did this a number of times because he seemed like he had that all this stuff down for like, okay, here's the spiel, here's the speech. And, you know, it must have been like, well, if I don't explain it well enough, then the guy will start coming after me again. So he like kind of had a whole like thing going. But anyway, so the next scene we're introduced to Jay. She's in her pool. She goes into the house and then we meet her sister, Kelly, and then Kelly's friends, Paul and Yara. As we were talking before about kind of like the timeless nature of the film, it's weird because one of the few things of a few pieces of technology we see is some sort of seashell or clamshell that Yara is using to read, like an e-reader.
It's like a seashell Kindle you can fold.
Which obviously, if you're hanging out with your friends, you're mm-hmm. reading books while you're hanging out with them.
Mm-hmm. While they watch like 50s movies on the TV, on the 90s era TV.
On a TV on top of a TV.
Also, holy crap, I just realized you talked about the idea of like being a kid and then facing your mortality. The amniotic quality of the first shot of the main character being in water, like as a metaphor for like the womb, you know?
Yeah,
it's
like, yeah.
That's a metaphor for like
that's true.
Pre-birth, you know? That's not an accident.
Also, like they cut to the pool a few times and it's like, I think you see her there again and like she's, instead of it being like she's looking to see if the kids are like peeping on her or something, it's then to see is the thing like following her. And then later, I think she goes by the pool and like the pool was destroyed later. So it's like kind of like a destruction of her innocence and stuff.
I like the little motif of those little kids throughout where it's like they're like creeping on the hot older neighbor and they're like, they're basically like next in line, you know, they're like, they're kind of starting their like sexual awakening and coming out of like childhood. So it's like,
they're smart.
Like, they're also following these teenagers around the whole time, just kind of trying to get a glimpse into their lives.
So next we see Jay goes on a date with Hugh. So they're going to the movies seeing, was it Charade? Who's in that? I forget who's in.
It was like Cary Grant or something.
Cary Grant, yeah. So they're in line for the movie and they play a game where they pick people that they would want to trade places with. We mentioned this just a few minutes ago. So the really interesting part is Hugh picking a child and like, you know, he's because I guess we learn later, obviously him dealing with like his own mortality. He's like, man, things are so much easier as a kid.
Yeah.
Life's ahead of you, all this stuff, you know. So I think that's a good little little detail there that I think supports kind of like our preference of viewing this more as like a thing about mortality and getting old and stuff. So then they go in the theater and Hugh sees a girl with a yellow dress and Jay doesn't see her. So he freaks the fuck out and they have to leave. And she's pretty cool with it, all things considered. And then later on, we see her go on another date with him. Then they have sex in the car. And she kind of has like a little bit of like, I don't know, kind of a heartfelt like story she's talking about wanting to hold hands with somebody and go somewhere. And while she's doing that, he chloroforms her. And then like she wakes up in a wheelchair and he's like, all right, I have to tell you about all these rules here. Okay.
This is when he goes over the rules.
Yeah. As anyone who's listened to the podcast or been on the podcast knows, I am not succinct at all. So I was slightly impressed with how quick he was at explaining things. But,
but basically, you would be explaining it and the person would just be dead by the time you're like halfway through explaining it.
But yeah, so he tells her she needs to have sex with someone to pass it on. And if, you know, she has to explain that to them or it'll come back to her and then back to Hugh, which is not what he wants. So,
yeah. And this is also when he explains that this person can take different forms. You know, it can be it can be a complete stranger. It can be a loved one, friend, family member.
I was going to ask you guys this now. Have either of you picked up on like any sort of rules in that department? Because at first I was considering maybe the forms that it takes would be maybe former like victims or something. Mm-hmm. But at one
which
point
it did, I think, at with the woman peeing herself.
Yeah, because she looked like someone who was. But it also takes the form of Yara and like Jay's father. But maybe those are put in there to, you know, kind of mess with you so that way you don't actually know the rules of what it can or cannot do.
Yeah, I think it's intentionally left a little vague. And like, you know, the fact that it can take the form of someone you know is pretty scary, too. Mm-hmm. Does he mention that no one else can see it?
He does.
Oh, yeah. He does. Yeah. No one.
Yeah,
can
that's
see
one.
It.
That's one of the rules, too, is like the person that it's following is the only person who can see.
But it's a smart way of characterizing the creature, too, because the fact that like it can just decide to be anybody means that like this thing is choosing who it like choosing its appearances very deliberately to fuck with people. Like,
oh, yeah.
It
yeah.
characterizes the creature as someone that's like very playful and someone that like is very sadistic. As opposed to something that just like
it's not just about killing,
right? It's not just about killing. Like it characterizes the creature as like taking, I mean, you know, taking joy in it, which is a really smart way of doing that because the character doesn't have dialogue. You know, the character can't be like, yeah. "Oh, for long I've waited." You know, it's not Mark Hamill.
So she's tied up. She is told all this stuff, and then he then says, "Oh, she's coming." And then like we see this naked lady walking towards her. And then it just cuts to her sister Kelly and her friends hanging out on the porch. Hugh pulls up and then just kind of like pulls Jay out of the car and then drives away. It's very disturbing how that is played, I think. Feels very traumatic. And then you get the cops that show up and are talking to her and that basically Hugh isn't really Hugh and that where she thought he lived is not where he lives. Then we get like a really uncomfortable scene of her at school and seeing this like old lady who's just like coming across the courtyard straight towards Jay. And she's like, all right, I'm getting the hell out of here. And then in the hallway, it's like she's walking. This old lady's like walking down the hallway and there's like the difference in age of like all these like young people standing there. And then she's just walking past them and they're not like noticing her. That gives off such an off-putting feeling that like that's like wrong. There's something wrong here. You know, it's like betraying some like social norms or something with that.
Yeah, that seems really spooky. And that's, you know, up until then, it's like you said, John, she's kind of like trying to process this trauma. Like you could probably argue that she is more kind of flustered and upset about, you know, what Hugh did and the abuse and getting tied up and chloroform mm-hmm. and all this. And I don't think she's immediately like buying into this, like it follows thing. She is creeped out. She saw like somebody like walking towards them, but it's like when she starts seeing the old lady, then it's like it kind of shifts to like, oh, this is real. Like this is really, mm-hmm. this is really freaking creepy.
Yeah. Like once the old lady shows up, it's kind of like, oh, this is definitely feels more real.
You'll get glimpses of these people just like walking like through people and going like unnoticed, not like through them as, or they're like,
yeah, but like
physically passing
people
through
are like talking.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then she walks through and it's like, they don't change like their eyesight.
Right. So Jay is pretty creeped out at this point. And so Paul offers to come sleep over at her house and keep watch. And Paul is a little sweet on Jay, we learned.
Very sweet on Jay. He's the first one to be like, I'll sleep with you and take the goon away from you. I'll do it. I'm your white knight, baby.
It's so
he acts like he's so noble about it. It's so funny.
It's like he just sees an opportunity to like get some. He's like, all right, that was a freebie. Let's do it. But yeah, so they have this little moment on the couch where they're talking about growing up, and you know, they say, you know, they were each other's first kiss, and then Jay has this little dig and just like, oh, you also kissed my sister Kelly
right after that. Yeah.
Yeah. So,
which I wonder, like, I'm assuming that has to be, or at least my vibe on this was, that fucked things up between him and Jay.
Yeah. You can tell that there's like, there's history in this little circle. And it's like, you know, it goes back to the proximity. Like they all just kind of grew up together and they shared a lot of firsts together and a lot of, you know, coming of age experiences together. So they're talking, watching TV, and a window breaks in the kitchen. And, you know, Paul checks it out. He's like, nothing's there.
Useless Paul.
So Paul checks it out. He doesn't see anything. There's just a broken window. So Jay goes into the kitchen and then she sees this woman walking towards her, like just peeing, and she's freaked out. She runs upstairs, locks the door.
As anyone would be if they saw someone just one tit out and then just pissing all over the floor.
Justifiable freak out.
Yeah,
for sure. So she runs upstairs. She locks herself in her room. Her friends start knocking on the door. They're like, you know, let us in. What's going on? She lets in her sister, Kelly, and Paul. And then they hear like another knock at the door and like, you know, the doorknob's rattling. And it's Yara. She says like, you know, let me in. And then we get one of the creepiest shots in the film. When she opens the door, you just see Yara standing there. And then this like 8-foot guy emerges from the shadows with these like blacked out eyes and just like hovers over her.
Yeah.
And just like the lighting in that is so good. He just like, it's like you see like body, face, and it's pretty terrifying. And then the way he just kind of like slinks into the room, like after just like kind of casually like sneaks in with her. And then Jay flips out. She runs outside. She gets on her bike and then she goes to the park. And that's when we talked about the scene earlier when she's sitting on the swing set and she has this quiet moment and, you know, there's this stillness and she's just, you know, just kind of
remembering
sitting there
waiting. Better times.
Yeah.
Her own mortality. You know?
I think it is safe to say that she has had much better times at this swing set than this night. So everybody finally catches up with her and then we see Greg across the street, neighbor Greg. He kind of pops up. We have this little fake out, like, is he a follower? Is he a real person? But it's just Greg. They can see him. It's good. And then Paul is not happy about this, but
oh. I was going to say, yeah.
So Paul has spent all this time trying to be like the guy. He wants to be the guy.
Yeah.
He has planted a lot of seeds. And Greg shows up, and within the span of 30 seconds, Greg is now the guy. Greg's
got a car.
Greg has a car.
He's just a hot dude, you know?
Greg is hot. He is older. He has a car. And he is not afraid of anything. And there's all these little knowing looks from Paul throughout.
Yeah, he knows.
Not a fan.
It's usually the opposite. It's usually a guy named Paul stealing Greg's girl. I know from experience.
Paul would know.
Eat shit, Greg.
Paul would know. So Greg has a car. And he offers to drive them to where Hugh's house is supposed to be. They get there and it has all these little kind of like booby traps of like cans and bottles hanging everywhere so he could hear someone entering.
A lot of tissues. And Paul's not really that scared off from looking through those magazines with those tissues right there.
He sure is not. And neither is Paul in the movie.
This bit will never get old.
Yeah, in case we didn't clarify, Paul speaks for all Pauls in the world. in this world and others, apparently.
It follows. So, sorry. I'm done.
Okay.
Good night.
Okay. Those corny jokes are for Jason only.
And 9 out of 10 get cut out. So
yeah.
Thank God.
But luckily, Paul did look through those magazines because he finds a picture of Hugh and this girl wearing like a varsity jacket. And he's like, yeah, I know this high school. You know, they're the whatever, the Badgers. Let's go. Let's go check it out. So they go to the high school and we get this kind of like, you know, 360 shot that goes around a couple times. It's that's kind of interesting, just kind of showing the school and showing them talking to, you know, somebody who has this info, and they seem to give it up pretty easily. So then at that point, they find his real name. He's actually a Jeff. He's not a Hugh.
Oh, man.
Jeff.
What a dweeb.
What a classic Jeff move. So they go to his house, his mom's house, we should say.
His mom lets them all in.
Yeah. I would have loved, we don't see this scene. It's effective the way it is. Like it's basically all these people, all these kids show up. They're like, is Jeff here? We're like friends of his. And then the next scene is like all of them sitting in the backyard with Jeff. I would have loved to see that interaction. Like, come on in, like, Jeff, your friends are here. And he's like, oh shit.
Like, the best thing would be if during that cut and they're in the yard, if they all had like juice boxes.
Yeah.
Like, mom really came through.
Some marshmallow squares.
Totino's pizza rolls.
So they're all in the backyard and, you know, they're trying to get more info out of Jeff. And he's like, I don't really know. You know, all I know, this was a one night stand. I don't know her name. And he's like, his advice has not changed. He's like, just keep doing it with people. Like, spread it.
Just keep doing it with people.
Like,
man.
He's really looking out for number one, because like he doesn't want it to catch back up with him. He wants to kind of separate himself as much as possible.
And he advises her to drive far away and she can kind of think on that. So that kind of encourages where the next scene goes.
Greg with the car takes them all to his lake house. Of course, he has a lake house too. So, like, yeah. Paul is just like getting notched down, you know, step after step. He's got nothing to contribute anymore. He's still willing to do it with Jay, but he doesn't have a car. He doesn't have a lake house. He doesn't have a gun. Greg has a gun. Greg is out here showing her how to shoot at the lake house. So they're all laying by the lake. It feels like the first kind of peaceful break for them in a while. They're all just kind of chilling, swimming, just sitting there. There's this calmness, there's this stillness again. But then we as the audience are the first to see someone who looks like Yara approaching Jay from the back.
And I like that they slowly, like, it's not like she shows up a couple steps and then shit happens. It's like all the way in the background you see her coming.
Yeah, we see her walking up. It's probably a good 30 seconds or so. And then there's this really kind of interesting shot that turns really bombastic for a few seconds. Like, you see her hair just rise. You don't see anyone behind her. You see someone pull up her hair and everybody's like, what is happening? And then it's just like kind of chaos for a little bit. And Paul gets punched like 10 feet and we don't see the it. Like, we're seeing like invisible it. We're just seeing like chairs flying. And
it feels pretty reminiscent of the first murder in Nightmare on Elm Street. Where you see like kind of her, the girl getting hit against the walls and stuff, and you don't see Freddy.
Right.
So kind of, it feels like a little bit of an homage there.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good comparison. So they run into this little like shed type thing. The it like kicks a hole in the door and this like little boy like tries to get in.
Well, there's also a part where the fake Yara gets shot in the neck. Falls down and is bleeding.
Yeah, we should mention that. Like, they, Jay still has the gun. Greg was outside peeing for all of this, so he's like a little behind. So when Jay starts firing, like, Greg is in the background trying to avoid the gunfire. Yeah. He hides behind a beach chair. Yara gets shot in the neck and we see blood splatter. She gets up pretty quickly. So we learn at this moment that, you know, you can't just shoot these things.
It's important to try, though.
Yeah. You got to try.
You got to shoot things in the head, you know.
So this little boy, he's trying to get in. Jay escapes from the shed. She takes Greg's car and just like leaves without anybody.
He's not happy about it either.
He's not. Well, he just got shot at a bunch, too. Like,
yeah,
Greg is justifiably pissed. And shortly down the road, truck is backing out of a driveway and Jay is looking behind her and she doesn't see it. She swerves and she goes into this cornfield. It's a really cool shot, kind of like almost a POV of mm-hmm. the windshield going through a cornfield. I would love to know how they did that. That shot.
All right. So Jay wakes up in the hospital and you know what? Greg's looking at her when she wakes up, gives her a little bit of the bedroom eyes. And, you know, they have sex apparently with the curtain open.
Yeah.
Kind of weird. But you know what? He's protecting her. It has nothing to do with anything for him. He's just being altruistic 100%.
Yeah. He doesn't even want to have sex with her. Yeah.
I do think, you know, he thought she was icky, but he did it anyway to be a good guy.
We have just a lot of noble intentioned guys in this.
Yeah. It's weird, huh?
Right.
Yeah. But so, then the next scene we see is Greg chatting up some girls.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's implied that he's getting it on.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
He's finding more partners, which is why he's then like, I haven't even seen it.
Yeah.
I don't even see the thing. I don't even think it's real, which it's like, yeah, that's why, idiot.
Don't worry about it. There's no problems here, you know?
Sending these girls to their deaths.
Well, it's so funny because like she is like having almost like a meltdown over it because why was it affecting her? And then it goes to him and then all of a sudden it's not around anymore. What was happening? And it's like, well, you know, Greg with a car, he's getting some, obviously. That's what's happening. Come on, Jay. You're smarter than this. So Jay's like kind of hanging out in her room. And then later she's looking out the window and she sees Greg walking down the street looking kind of odd. And he walks up to supposedly to his own house, can't open the door. So then he just breaks a window and goes in. And she's like, huh, that's not right. So she calls stupid Greg, and stupid Greg didn't answer his phone. So she runs in there to help him, which I think is a little bit more than what Greg deserves. But
yeah, I was thinking the same thing when she starts like sprinting over there. I'm like, maybe call one more time before you do that.
Right. Well, keep in mind that if she can save him, she will save herself.
True.
But also, who, you never, you know, it's logic 101. You never run toward the house where the killer is.
Yeah, no.
Then when it kills Greg,
yeah,
you're right there, baby. In the vicinity, baby.
So she is late enough to catch the shapeshifter thing turning into Greg's mom, mm-hmm. kind of naked. And then finally, Greg opens the door and then she fucks him to death.
Greg's like, Mom, what are you doing?
Not again.
Well, she walks in and sees, you know, her humping him to his death. And she just says, well, he's fucked.
She did try. She gave it the old college try.
But don't forget the scene right before she opens the door where the killer locks eyes with what's her name?
Yeah.
They lock eyes and just stare at each
like,
other.
Yeah, she's like, I'm coming for you next, baby.
See you soon. Yeah.
It's like the best scene in the movie. It's like so hot.
So then we get Jay. She drives away and then she sleeps outside on top of her car. And then she wakes up to see some dudes in a boat. And she's like, I got an idea here.
This is such a strange play well, out of her playbook.
Because it's like she tried to play nice, and then she's getting more desperate as it goes along. Mm-hmm. And I think it kind of gives a little insight into how Hugh/Jeff, maybe how things turned out for him, where he got more and more desperate and whatever.
Well, it's almost like at that point, you're like, well, at least Hugh like told her what was going on.
It's like
there definitely is desperation at this point, and like Paul is still backburnered to three random dudes on a boat.
It's happened
before for sure.
Okay, so then we got, she's back at her house And then Paul, we mentioned this earlier, Paul offers his penis to her as a gift. He's nobly, yeah. And he's like, hey, I'll do it if you want. You know? Yeah. And then very awkwardly, he goes in for a little smooch, and then she like turns away, and it's like, oh, ouch, Paul. Sorry. But you know what? Good thing that happened, because then Paul has the genius idea that they'll go to the pool, and that's how they'll set their trap for it.
What a terrible idea. Like, I'm sorry. It's just like...
So interestingly, I read an interview with the director, and he talked about how it was the way that most movies would work is that there would be some sort of detail that occurred in one of the prior scenes where they're getting chased that they would go, oh, we're going to unlock this idea of like, oh, that's how we get him. Mm-hmm. And then like, usually it would probably be like, oh, there's something about like it would drown in water or it can't swim. Yeah, and then they do the thing. But instead, they don't have any of that. It's just dumb teen Paul just came up with a dopey plan. And he's like, we're going to do this. And everyone's just like, let's do it. Right. Let's go, yeah, guys.
It's like you shot it in the neck earlier and it bought you guys maybe 5 seconds. Yeah. And you're like, oh, well, maybe we can electrocute it. Like, doubt it. Shot it already. Like, you're kind of working backwards now.
Yeah, it's like the unfortunate like quagmire of like the writer is like locking themselves into something where like, if it were me, I have no idea what I would do. Mm-hmm. I have no idea how I would end that movie. Because it's like there has to be some sort of, no pun intended, but like climax, you know? And like, if you want to be altruistic, it has to end with like the suggestion, at least, of these kids beating the thing. But like the unfortunate thing about like this concept of this killer is like, there's not really any feasible way to down it.
Yeah, you can't cheat death.
Right. Forever. And this thing is invulnerable, and it's right. They've had it got shot multiple times. They've had it get up. It changes form. You know, it's like shooting it a bunch of times, like, isn't going to like, so what can you do? I mean, frankly, that's an actual question. Like, and maybe we should save this for after the summary, but like, how would you guys have, cause I don't know, how would you guys have ended this movie?
That's a good question. I mean, Or at least how would we have approached trying to, like, if we were these kids, how would we have tried to kill it? Or
so I think you paint yourself into a corner like a little bit when you write a villain like this, you know?
I think some of the intention was kind of the ambiguity of it and the inevitability of it. So I see it on that regard. So I guess the pool scene works for me and you know, the inevitability aspect. Like, it's like, well, we tried our darndest. We threw a bunch of toasters into the water and... You know,
well, they didn't even get that far.
The execution was quite poor.
on top of it works for me too, because I, at the end of the day, like, there is that Goonies quality you talked about, and you want to see the kids kick ass. You know, you want to see them beat the thing's ass. You have to suspend your disbelief a little bit.
They're not that inventive, though. It's just like, oh, we'll throw these things and electrocute it in the pool, and then the it gets the best of them and starts throwing the electronics in to electrocute Jay, and it does nothing because the pool's too big.
Well, luckily Paul has amazing aim.
Oh yeah.
shoots it right in the head, even though we can't see it.
Well, he's missed his shot a lot thus far, so it's good that he gets a couple headshots in.
And it's a metaphor because he shoots his shot.
Yeah.
Shoots a shot multiple times.
That was the joke I was making.
Oh shit, I'm really slow, dude.
Yo, Paul, I love you.
I love you too, man. So happy to be here with you.
It's like, I love you, but I'm cutting out the part where you stole my joke.
I'm not gonna cut it out. I want people to hear me hector him about it.
So here's a question. Can the its be locked in something? Could you put this in like a bank safe? Like, could it? How superhuman is it?
I don't know. Like, I would assume it would.
Because we've already established it has to go through windows and kick down doors.
Yeah.
So I don't know. That, I mean, if we're still talking about ideas, I'd try bank vault. Dibs on bank vault. But
okay.
I think you're right, because they've also established that it has to walk. It can't drive a car. Mm-hmm. It can't. So it's like, if we're giving it that kind of vulnerability, then it can break through bank vaults, but it's limited to like walking
maybe at the speed of an old
woman. Yeah. Like, it would be very silly for them to be like, It has to, it doesn't have any, it has to walk. It's limited to walking on 2 feet, but it can teleport through land. Like, that wouldn't be consistent, right?
Well, I wonder, maybe it would just break open the bank vault. It's that strong. I don't know.
Yeah, but it knocks on doors. It knocks on doors waiting for people to answer them.
It likes to fuck with people.
It goes knock, knock, knock.
Yeah.
No, well, that's true. It does like to fuck with people. That's true.
So maybe it would knock and then the bank teller would be like, oh, what's going on here? Oh no. But I mean, I would like to know when it figured out it couldn't drive. Like it managed to open the car door, it sits down, and then it's just like, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm out of my depths here.
Can this thing like, can this thing like learn? Like, could it like over all these years or months or whatever the timeline is of this thing existing, do you think it's like getting smarter? I don't think we get any hints that it's like getting smarter or like learning new skills. I think it just remains as the it.
So also the question of like whether it can do way more than it does, but it just chooses not to. It's like, yeah, I can I have my pilot's license.
Yeah, what if there's a sequel where it can like fly and shoot fire and stuff.
Right.
Where'd it get a jetpack from?
It still follows.
What if it is the friends we made along the way?
Where are we here? So, Paul, he shoots Yara by accident.
He does.
And I thought he killed her at first. And it turned out it was just in the leg. And I was like, this is dark. And then Kelly actually has a smart idea and throws a sheet over it. And Paul shoots it in the head and then goes in the water and then starts trying to drown Jay. And Paul, I think it's a miracle he didn't shoot Jay at all in that sequence. Because
yeah,
I would have hit Jay accidentally. So
they're in the pool and it's like it is grabbing like Jay's legs and they're like kind of forming one long kind of person or one long target. And Paul is trying to shoot over top of her, barely over top of her, and get the and he nails it. We would have to assume out of sheer luck.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, that was a smart move from Kelly. And that, like, she thought that out. She like packed a blanket, like she packed like a little sheet. So, you know, props to Kelly for that one.
Then when Jay gets out of the pool, you then see like this really cool shot of like this blood just clouding the water. And it's like because it's like CGI blood. It looked like it gives it kind of this weird quality. And it feels kind of foreboding, though. Like, is this it? Is it over? Or is there going to be more bloodshed?
It's kind of like it starts as like a normal amount of blood and then it almost like just like billows to fill almost the whole pool. And it looks, you know, almost kind of artificial and ominous. And we've already, like, we go back to this, like, you know, shooting it doesn't work. Like, it's I don't know.
Well,
because it's CGI blood and it looks almost like smoke and it's like billowing out, it almost gives you the feel of like it almost looks like it gives like it's like the creature itself is dissipating.
Mm-hmm.
Like the creature itself
makes sense.
Being released from its form.
It's the pool now.
For now, you know?
So we're focusing on that, but let's be honest, the best scene occurs when Jay and Paul, they finally...
Paul, baby!
They finally have sex. And
which is weird, too, because it's like, Paul's... is it like, Paul sure earned it.
Yeah. Well, that's it has like a little bit of a weird exchange where it's like, he asks her if she feels different. She shakes her head and then she says it to him, like, what about you? And he says no. And that could be taken in so many different ways. Like, what does that mean? Like, I don't know. I've kind of feel like, even though like it seems like they're kind of dating at the end, I get the sense that he is way more into her than she is into him.
Yes.
And so like I kind of feel like she's just like, okay,
it feels like a sympathy gesture almost. Like part of me feels like if Greg made it through this, they'd be like dating the next week. And then like
but the thing though is it almost kind of felt like when they finally have sex, it's like maybe she was kind of being like, well, let's see if there's chemistry here, you know, give it a shot. Yeah. And then afterwards
he keeps asking,
yeah,
I don't know. Well, I mean, I will say it made quick work out of those, the three dudes that she used it for like buffer time.
Yeah.
They did not last
it's
very
because
long.
Dudes don't last very long.
You're like getting close to like Liam level of like sexual jokes.
I can't be that. No.
Dude, you're doing it more sweetly, but
you're close. Like the vulgarity levels are.
Oh, true. That's true. But
these are gateway comments, Paul. They're gateway comments. You're going to be talking about squirrel tail.
I got to go to a program.
All right. So anyway, the end of the movie is Jay and Paul. They're walking down the street. And then we see like, you know, a figure in the background kind of walking behind them. And then it cuts. And we don't know. Is it back? You know, I feel like it is. I assume that must be for like the whole thing about the inevitability of death and stuff. It has to live on, you know?
Yeah. I would say so as well. I mean, shooting it in a pool, I don't think that was the answer. It is kind of weird how it just like kind of arbitrarily turned into just like a cloud of blood. Like, mm-hmm. Why there? Why was it like, oh, all you got to do, the perfect combo of bullets and water, and that does it. No, I think it's definitely still around.
I was going to ask this. Would, if you had a choice, who would you pass it on to?
Well, that's an insane question, I think.
my sock?
Yeah, how does that work? Well, I think Hugh already tried that. Hugh found out that didn't work.
So, you know, movie's over. Okay, so let's compare this to the other films we have seen in the series. So we have Peeping Tom, Psycho, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Black Christmas, Halloween, Nightmare on Elm Street, Scream, Behind the Mask, and You're Next. Jason.
Well, I think you kind of nailed it earlier. It was a good point you brought up about it being a nice hybrid of Halloween and Nightmare. But, you know, we got these different elements, too. Like some of these prior films, you know, the more memorable scenes were these crazy death scenes. And we don't really get that. It's a lot of implied gore. And, you know, you see a lot of like, I guess that or not even a lot, some of the aftermath of certain things.
But they do make that kind of shocking, though, even though it's not always super.
It's true.
Explicit.
Yeah. And no, it is still shocking. And, you know, it's unsettling in its own right. Have we had any that where like a killer can take different forms yet?
I mean, Freddy.
I mean, that goes back to the Nightmare comparison. But I think this one was just a good practice in, you know, building anxiety and dread. And I don't know. What are your feelings, John? Like, you, I know you already made the Halloween and Nightmare comparisons. How do you think this kind of falls into everything?
Well, I kind of mentioned it before, but I think the for me, it was the not fully defined rules for like how mm-hmm. this killer works. And that kind of creates a lot of, you know, uneasiness with like the viewer, but also the characters. So we kind of, I feel like it puts the puts us in the character's shoes pretty easily. I mm-hmm. think. And all these people, you know, they seem like, you know, normal kids.
Would you consider Jay like a final girl?
Yes.
You would, Paul?
Yeah, like a subversion of the final girl trope, you know? Like mm-hmm. definitely like rooted in the final girl.
In the grand scheme of it, she hasn't really done much better or worse than anyone else who's handled this. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, she's still alive at the end, but who's mm-hmm. to say how long? And, you know, she stooped to Hugh's level, you could argue, at one point.
But I think you made a good point, Jason, in that, like historically, final girls, like, often were the ones with, like, the pristine morality, whereas, like, Jay is making all these mistakes and doing these kind of dubious things. And, like, that's why I think that that's, like, a subversion of the final girl trope in mm-hmm. that, like, she does fuck up and ultimately doesn't really triumph and still, like, I'll just like surviving is mm-hmm. still victory, you know? And if we're going on like the theme of like sexual trauma conversation, like, yeah, like surviving is still victory. And like nobody's Jamie Lee Curtis, you know, in Halloween.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And she she confronts him, you know, mm-hmm. having to wait in that pool. Not a great idea, but she still like, you know, stood there to face him and, you know.
It never goes away, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just
and
interesting.
Like teenagers being allowed to fuck up too. Yeah, it's like a different outlook.
Right. And it's like, absolutely. It is kind of, you know, it goes back to the whole youth aspect, you know, they're just trying to figure out this crazy existence. And, you have a lot of bad ideas when you're growing up. Throwing toasters in the pool just happened to be one of theirs. And,
right.
You know, I think she kind of, Jay kind of represents that. She kind of represents, you know, the mistakes you make as a youth and, you know, kind of goes back to the, you know, figuring out empathy and responsibility and things of that nature. It's also, it's just tough. Like I didn't feel like I was like super rooting for any character like the whole time. And it's tough because we watched Your Next right before this. And like, that has a very like easy final girl to root for. And she's like,
yeah,
really badass. And, I don't know. It's
she goes wild with it, you know.
Yeah. So I mean that kind of works against them, and it follows a little bit, I guess. You know, watching.
I agree with Paul about the some of the ambiguity of it. The moral ambiguity of it is it's just interesting, and I mean them being kind of on like the precipice of being an adult and kind of that feeling of it. I don't know if I really feel like with what you were saying, Jason, about the rooting for the characters as much as like I identify with like them and like the idea of like feeling this dread of what's to come or what's around the corner and things like that is more what I identify with more than necessarily like the characters being.
I think a lot of horror movies, especially in the 80s, like the text of the film assigns morality to people's actions. It's like the text of the film says that, like, supports the point of view that, like, if you don't have sex, you will win. And, like, this movie doesn't assign that point of view to sex. At the same time, it also doesn't assign, like, any point of view to it. It's like the authorial lens is, like, completely objective, which is why you're like, well, I'm not really rooting for anybody.
It's just
to die, but I'm not rooting for anybody.
Yeah, it's just something that exists, and like it or not, it can have consequences, and you know they have to be dealt with one way or another. I don't know. I like this one. I told John earlier. I don't know if it's my favorite of the slasher series. I kind of go back and forth on it. To me, it like wasn't one of the scarier ones. I don't know. That sounds like I'm trying to be like a tough guy, but you know what I mean? It's just like, I think there were some really eerie sequences, but I don't know. That's just where I stand on it.
For me, I find some of the unknowable nature of it to be what kind of makes me, not. I don't know about scared. Me saying I'm scared of anything seems like I'm not that way about horror movies so much. But like, it makes me uncomfortable. I get tense. I get anxiety is more what I feel whenever if I watch an effective horror movie or something.
This
gave me anxiety. So.
I brought it up before how I watched Blair Witch recently, and that straight up was scary to me. And I didn't feel that as much. And that's a little unfair comparison because I feel like that's probably universally regarded as one of the scarier films ever made, Blair Witch. But I mean, I don't know. I like it, but I do, John, we talked about this, you know, a little leading up to this. I feel like the director, you got to help me with his name.
Robert Mitchell.
I think. He did I believe it was his follow-up to this called Under the Silver Lake, which I'm a big fan of. John, I know you like it as well. I think it might be a little underrated.
I love it.
I think it's a little, I mean, people didn't, I guess it didn't get the highest praise, but I think it's very good. And I feel like he kind of came into his craft more in that film. And
it's more ambitious, too, I think.
I tend to kind of view It Follows, you know, through that lens of Silver Lake, because I think I did like Silver Lake more. So I think that's like, I can see areas like what he was going for in certain aspects of It Follows. But then after watching Under the Silver Lake, it's like, oh man, like he's, you know, he learned some new tricks, and I would have liked to see some of these new tricks maybe in It Follows and just expand on a few things. But I mean, these are minor gripes. It's still a great film.
I would point out that I like something that carried over from It Follows to Under the Silver Lake is that his kind of focus on like youth culture and like younger characters and the stuff they're going through.
And his just his like knack for trying to shake up a genre a little bit, not necessarily subvert, but you know, like in Silver Lake was more noir kind of, you know, drawing
a lot
attention.
Of comedy in there too.
Yeah, drawing attention to those aspects. So,
Well, that speaks to what I love about It Follows so much, is that like at a certain point into a genre's lifespan, you can, the kind of the only thing you can do with it to make it great is to absolutely turn it on its head. And I feel like certain staples of the slasher genre, it's like, where is the killer? Where is it hiding? It Follows, it's what is the killer? And then putting it in plain sight. Oh, the killer is something that walks. We're going to go to a high school where there's people walking all the time.
Yeah.
Have fun. Have a field day. Like, that's kind of genius, you know? It's like, or, you know, there's the whole thing of like in a lot of slasher films, the killer kind of becomes the protagonist. Like, you root for Jason to kill these kids. Like, after the third movie, you're rooting for Freddy, you're rooting for Michael Myers. Like,
yeah,
they are the hero.
You tune in for the killers, because right. They're the most, they are the franchise at that point. So,
right. So, right. And by, yeah.
So having said that, we got to ask the question we always ask, would you survive this killer? John, what do you think?
No. No. I mean, could you have expected any other answer from me? Like, I would have rolled over immediately and been like, all right, I'm done. No. Like, I gotta run. I gotta outrun this guy. I would say there'd be like two road trips, and by the second time he catches up, I'm like, I can't keep doing this.
I can't afford these trips anymore.
Jason won't let me come over to Lancaster anymore. So, all right, just kill me now. Life's not worth living. Come on. What about you, Jason?
This would be one of the more annoying ones, because it's like, it's implied that you can't really
get laid again.
It's implied you can't really like do anything about it. And so it would just kind of get exhausting. Like, I think instance to instance, I could very easily get away from this thing, but it could just eventually wear me down. And how does it work? You know, I'm a married man, boys. You know, do you like, is it like passed back and forth? Like each time? Like how, okay. what are the okay. rules there? Like
you
it's like the
swingers
right,
club.
This is a very subtle humble brag from Jason right now.
No, but like it's a logical question, right? It's like if you have one partner, does it like default start with me and then it's like her next time and then, or does it, I don't know, is it grandfathered in to me? Like who knows? These are,
Jason's like, so imagine your marriage is going like really well. Like really well. Like you're a couple of rabbits, you know? Which thing does it decide to go for?
It's like constant. I'm saying that there's a back and forth nature to it. It's a valid question in the context of,
I get what you're saying. Yeah.
Would I survive this? So Paul, are you surviving?
Yeah, I put my chastity pants on and no, the thing is, you'd have to be rich to survive, like very wealthy, because you'd have to like go to another continent, like fly to Italy. You'd have to calculate the amount of time it would take for the thing to walk to Italy on the bottom of the ocean, mm-hmm. like set a timer. And in like 3 years, when it's a couple days away, you fly back to the States and you'd just have to do that. Otherwise, dead. So yeah, I'm not wealthy. I live on a theater actor and Uber Eats salary. So dead. Big dead. Dead immediately. No question.
Well, everyone but Jason is dead, because Jason would sleep with running shoes on.
What?
You're not engaging my silliness tonight, Jason.
Sleep with running shoes on.
Because you said you could deal with it. Like for, you're like, it's coming. The door's knocking.
Yeah,
it's there.
For a time. But I do think it would wear me down eventually. This would be a frustrating one. I think I would, you know, down the road, I would probably die.
Do you think you could take it down with you?
Oh, is that an option?
I don't know. It's our podcast.
What if you sleep with the it?
I think it kills
Greg
you.
Greg did.
Yeah, it kills you.
It does.
I think that's what it
but
does.
But what if like people. You seduce it and it doesn't want to kill you?
Right.
We don't have
Jason's
time for these
like,
questions.
Jason's I could bag it. And you could, man. You're 10.
Thanks, Paul.
You're a married man. You can't talk like this. All right. Well, Paul, thank you so much for being on the podcast. It was great to have you.
Yeah, thanks,
on.
Man. It was fun.
Thanks for
glad
having
you're,
me.
Glad
you guys.
You're doing well. Things are picking up. Sounds like you have
you
fun
guys are
things
the coolest.
Coming up.
Can't wait till we can all hang out.
Love you, buddy.
Love you too, guys.
All right, that does it for this week's episode. Please remember to rate, review, and subscribe. Next week, we will be reviewing Halloween 2018. Until then,
stab you later.
It was exhilarating to hear Stabulator in real time. You know? I'm like, it's just like the show.